Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
My thanks to Tattered Cover for inviting me tonight to share some of my ideas and thoughts with you, and thanks most of all to all of you for coming out. I appreciate it. What I'd like to do is spend a few minutes talking about some of the main ideas in The Shallows, and woven into that, read a couple of very brief passages from the book to give you a sense or a feel for it, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have, and then sign any books that you may have, even ones not by me. I'm good at forging other people's signatures. So, the spark for The Shallows was really my own personal experience. Like many people, I spent a lot of time using computers throughout most of my adult life, and certainly was an avid and continue to be an avid user of the internet and other digital media. But what I noticed a few years ago is that my ability to concentrate seemed to be eroding. And I noticed this in particular when I'd sit down and try to read a book. And this is reading a book, reading literature, anything else, is something that had always come natural to me in my life. But I noticed that when I sat down these days and started to try to read something, after a few paragraphs or after at most a couple of pages, I'd lose my train of thought. And what I noticed is that my mind seemed to want to do what it did whenever I was sitting down in front of a computer or otherwise online. It wanted to, you know, start clicking links, do some Googling, jump from page to page to page, check my email. And at first, you know, I assumed that this inability to pay attention, to concentrate, was probably just a manifestation of some middle-aged mind rot or something. And there's probably some of that involved. But what I noticed is the sensation wasn't simply of a wandering mind or a distracted mind. It was very much that my brain seemed to be hungry. It wanted more information, more stimulus. It wanted to do what it did when I'm online. So I began to look into both the history of technology and some of the recent findings about neuroscience, about how our brains adapt to the environment, including the tools that we use to find information, to gather information, and so forth. And what I discovered pretty quickly is that the tools that we use to think with, what I call in the book our intellectual technologies, influence the way that we think. And I believe you can trace the course of that influence throughout the history, particularly the intellectual history of humankind. And in the book, I go all the way back to, for instance, the map. And today, you know, it's hard to imagine that there was a time in human history that we didn't have maps. But in fact, at some point, many, many millennia ago, somebody had to invent the map. And before we had the map, we got around and we knew where we were, and we had our sense of location purely from our sensory perception, our ability to see our surroundings, to hear things, and so forth. The map gave us an abstract representation of space. And obviously, the map had all sorts of practical uses. It helped people get around in a way that they never used to be able to get around. It helped people establish boundaries and borders and so forth. But I think it, at a more deeper level, it changed the way people think. It gave us a more abstract mind, a mind that could see not only what our senses could perceive, but some of the abstract patterns and abstract representations that lay behind what we perceived about the world. And a very similar thing happened, I think, when we saw the introduction of the mechanical clock. much more recently than the map. But before then, again, our perception of time was as very, very much as a natural cyclical flow. And suddenly, with the mechanical clock, we took this flow and chopped it up into very small, precisely measurable pieces, seconds, minutes, hours. And again, there were all sorts of practical uses, obviously. We could schedule our days much more precisely than we could in the past. We could coordinate our schedules with other people, which was very important then because we were seeing the beginning of cities and industrialization and so forth. But again, I think the real impact of this technology, the intellectual technology of the mechanical clock, was that it gave us a more scientific mind, a mind that tried to measure things and saw more and more phenomena as something that could be measured. So both the map and the clock, among many, many different intellectual technologies, had profound effects on our minds in the way we think, even greater, I think, in the end, than their practical purpose. It's a common theme in our intellectual history that these inventions of tools that we use to think with, the effects they have are often very, very different or unimagined by the people who actually invented those tools, and certainly by the users of the tools as well, the early users in particular. But much of the book focuses on two much more recent intellectual technologies that both have, I think, or are having profound effects on the way we think. The first of those is the book, and in particular in its printed form. And the second is the Internet, and in particular the World Wide Web, the other kinds of services, email and so forth, that we've all come to enjoy over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And it's my argument that these two technologies, these two intellectual technologies, the book on the one hand, or the printed page more generally, and the Internet, are having very, very different effects on the way we think. When we think about the book, we tend to think in terms of the invention of the printing press by Gutenberg around 550 years ago in 1450. But in fact, the book was already well established as a tool for thinking with well before Gutenberg came along. And in fact, one of the most interesting developments in the history of the book happened about 1,000 years ago when some anonymous monk who was working as a scribe decided to insert spaces between words, the words that he wrote out. And it's amazing to think about this, particularly today, but up until then, just 1,000 years ago, which isn't very long, of course, in human history, there were no spaces between the words in any kind of written literature. And the reason for that was that people originally were just writing what they heard. And when you speak, when you talk, you don't stick spaces of time between every word. The syllables just kind of flow out and flow together. And in fact, if you watch how a child writes when a child's learning how to write, you'll see that they don't put spaces between words. They simply write what they hear. So the writing initially was simply a representation of the oral culture in which ideas were shared by people talking. The problem was that without spaces between words, it becomes very, very difficult to read. And you can try this. Try taking the spaces out and print out a page, and you really have to struggle. What happened after somebody began putting spaces in books and other printed material is that reading became much, much easier. And up until then, nobody read silently to themselves. You had to actually read out loud in order to figure out where one word ended and the next began. As soon as we had the introduction of word spaces, suddenly private silent reading became possible. And that created all sorts of, I think, deep effects in the way people thought and ultimately in our culture. And one of the most important effects was that the book, as a technology, I think, helped train us to pay attention. That was something very, very rare in life up until then. Certainly there were craftsmen and hunters and monks and so forth who had developed the capacity to pay attention to one thing. But the great achievement of the book, particularly after word spaces were put in, is that people who sat down and read a book, they were, in fact, shielded from all the distractions that normally bombard us moment by moment in our our lives, and as a result, they could begin to develop the capacity to pay attention, to concentrate, and they could use that capacity even when they weren't reading. So this was a revolution, I think, in human thought, in certainly in cultural history. And what Gutenberg did when he invented the printing press is he took this mode of thought that the printed page introduced and, in fact, popularized it. Suddenly, all sorts of people could get their hands on books or other printed material. In the past, before the printing press, it was so expensive because each one had to be handwritten that very, very few people ever saw the written word. So the first passage I'd like to read from The Shallows is a passage that deals with the effects, the intellectual effects, that the printed word had as people turned into readers for the first time. To read a long book silently required an ability to concentrate intently over a long period of time, to lose oneself in the pages of a book, as we now say. Developing such mental discipline was not easy. The natural state of the human brain, like that of the brains of most of our relatives in the animal kingdom, is one of distractedness. Our predisposition is to shift our gaze, and hence our attention, from one object to another, to be aware of as much of what's going on around us as possible. Our fast-paced, reflexive shifts in focus were once crucial to our survival. They reduced the odds that a predator would take us by surprise or that we'd overlook a nearby source of food. For most of history, the normal path of human thought was anything but linear. To read a book was to practice an unnatural process of thought, one that demanded sustained, unbroken attention to a single static object. It required readers to place themselves at what T.S. Eliot in Four Quartets would call the still point of the turning world. They had to train their brains to ignore everything else going on around them, to resist the urge to let their focus skip from one sensory cue to another. They had to forge or strengthen the neural links needed to counter their instinctive distractedness. The ability to focus on a single task, relatively uninterrupted, writes one research psychologist, represents a strange anomaly in the history of our psychological development. Many people had, of course, cultivated a capacity for sustained attention long before the book or even the alphabet came along. The hunter, the craftsman, the ascetic, all had to train their brains to control and concentrate their attention. What was so remarkable about book reading was that the deep concentration was combined with the highly active and efficient deciphering of text and interpretation of meaning. The reading of a sequence of printed pages was valuable not just for the knowledge readers acquired from the author's words, but for the way those words set off intellectual vibrations within the reader's own minds. In the quiet spaces opened up by the prolonged, undistracted reading of a book, people made their own associations, drew their own inferences and analogies, fostered their own ideas. They thought deeply as they read deeply. Even the earliest silent readers recognized the striking change in their consciousness that took place as they immersed themselves in the pages of a book. The medieval bishop Isaac of Syria described how, whenever he read to himself, "As in a dream, I enter a state when my sense and thoughts are concentrated. Then, when with this prolonging of this silence, the turmoil of memories is stilled in my heart, ceaseless waves of joy are sent to me by inner thoughts, beyond expectation suddenly arising to delight the heart." Reading a book was a meditative act, but it didn't involve a clearing of the mind. It involved a filling or replenishing of the mind. Readers disengaged their attention from the outward flow of passing stimuli in order to engage it more deeply with an inward flow of words, ideas, and emotions. That was and is the essence of the unique mental process of deep reading. It was the technology of the book that made this strange anomaly in our psychological history possible. The brain of the book reader was not just a literate brain, it was a literary brain. The internet, I think, has almost exactly the opposite effect on us, whether we're reading or using it for other purposes. If the great feat of the book, the printed page as a technology, was to shield us from distraction, the net inundates us with distraction. And that's one of the great strengths it has as a technology, as a intellectual technology. We value the ability to jump from link to link to link, to gather lots of information quickly. We value the fact that we can switch between different media, sounds, words, moving images, still images, even on a given, on just a single page. And we certainly value the fact that this is a technology that provides us with lots of messages and lots of alerts and connects us to many different people and many different things going on. And this is the reason, those are all reasons why we use the technology so much and kind of continually ratchet up our dependence on it. On the other hand, all of those distractions, all of those interruptions that are the essence of the technology of the internet also prevent us from exercising those deeply attentive ways of thinking that the book in the printed word provided us many, many years ago. The net is great at giving us access to lots of information and giving us streams of messages and alerts, but it provides no opportunity and certainly no encouragement to practice the more attentive modes of thought like contemplation, like reflection, like introspection. In fact, it seems to be designed to prevent us from exercising those modes of thought. And when you look at the scientific evidence, you see much cause, I think, for concern. There have been, over the last 10, 15, 20 years, and sometimes even longer than that, there have been many, many studies of the psychological and mental consequences of things like hypermedia and hypertext, in other words, text with links in it. There have been many studies of media multitasking when we're juggling different things on screen. There have been many studies of how interruptions such as email and texting and instant messages and so forth influence our thinking. And finally, there have been a lot of studies of multimedia, what happens to our thinking when we are getting information in many different forms rather than a single form. And the preponderance of that evidence all points to these aspects of the internet as a technology, as a medium, impeding our ability to comprehend what we're reading or what we're looking at, to understand it, to learn from what we're doing. And the reason is, in short, is that all of the deep, most profound aspects of human thought really require attentiveness. It's only by paying attention to something, to one thing, for instance, that we're able to move information from our short-term working memory, that's the very highly constrained in terms of capacity memory that we constantly are processing what we're seeing or what we're hearing moment by moment or the words we're looking at or the pictures we're looking at. In order to move information from that short-term store to our long-term memory, which is where we build conceptual knowledge, where we connect our memories, connect what we've learned in order to build deep conceptual understanding, you have to pay attention to that information. If you're constantly juggling many different tasks, if you're constantly shifting your attention from page to page, if you're constantly clicking on links, you never are able to transfer information from your short-term memory to your long-term memory. So you have access to lots of information, and often you feel as though you're getting smarter simply by being exposed to all these different things, but in fact you're never developing the richest forms of human understanding and human thought. There was, in particular, a fascinating and very troubling study undertaken at Stanford University just last year. And researchers from a lab there took a group of heavy media multitaskers, people who spent a lot of time looking into screens and juggling lots of things. And then they took a group of light multitaskers, people who had a much greater tendency to focus on one thing rather than juggle a lot of things. And they gave them a battery each group a battery of cognitive tests. And what they found was that on every single one of those tests, the heavy multitaskers did worse than the light multitaskers. And what was most amazing, and this even shocked the researchers themselves, was that the heavy multitaskers even did worse on tasks of multitasking. I mean, on tests of multitasking. And even though they thought that by juggling lots of information, they were getting better at it, what the researchers discovered is that people who multitask heavily are less efficient in switching from one job or one task to another, and also have less ability to distinguish important information from trivial information. So among the many studies that have been done, they all point in this direction that when we go online, when we enter this kind of information environment through these new technologies, we sacrifice many of the greatest qualities, I think, of human thought. And what's equally disturbing is what scientists have found about the brain's adaptability over the last few decades. If you're like me, you might have learned in school, for instance, that once we leave childhood, our brains are basically fixed, that all the circuits are laid when we're young, and then when you get in your 20s, that's it. You have what you've developed during your youth. And in fact, that's totally wrong. What neuroscientists and psychologists have discovered recently is that, in fact, our brains, even down at the cellular level, in the connections between our neurons, the synaptical connections, are constantly adapting to our environment, to our circumstances, and to what we're doing. So when we begin to use a new technology that encourages a certain mode of thought by getting us to practice that mode, those circuits, those neural circuits in our brain are constantly strengthened. But on the other hand, if that technology discourages us from practicing other modes of thought, those circuits in our brain weaken, and if we don't practice them at all, they slowly begin to fall apart, and the brain cells are literally repurposed for the types of activities we perform constantly and over and over. And, you know, what became pretty clear to me is that that was the reason, or one of the main reasons, for my own personal experience, that even when I wasn't sitting at a computer, I was having trouble concentrating, paying attention, whether it's reading or doing any other single task for a prolonged period of time, because the actual pathways in my brain and in all of our brains as we use these new technologies are changing. And the bottom line is, if you don't practice more attentive, contemplative modes of thought, you really risk losing your capacity to do that at all. And of course, if children are trained to constantly juggle tasks, to constantly be bombarded by information from a very young age, they risk not developing those other modes of thought at all. And that brings me to the second reading I'd like to do from the book. And this comes from quite late in the book, when I anticipate a question that readers will probably have by then, and maybe it's a question that some of you have already just by hearing me talk about some of the themes of The Shallows. I know what you're thinking. The very existence of this book would seem to contradict its thesis. If I'm finding it so hard to concentrate, to stay focused on a line of thought, how in the world did I manage to write a few hundred pages of at least semi-coherent prose? It wasn't easy. When I began writing The Shallows toward the end of 2007, I struggled in vain to keep my mind fixed on the task. The net provided, as always, a bounty of useful information and research tools, but its constant interruptions scattered my thoughts and words. I tended to write in disconnected spurts, the same way I wrote when blogging. It was clear that big changes were in order. In the summer of the following year, I moved with my wife from a highly connected suburb of Boston to the mountains of Colorado, Evergreen, Colorado, actually. There was no cell phone service at our new home, and the internet arrived through a relatively pokey DSL connection. I canceled my Twitter account, put my Facebook membership on hiatus, and mothballed my blog. I shut down my RSS reader and curtailed my Skyping and instant messaging. Most important, I throttled back my email application. It had long been set to check for new messages every minute. I reset it to check only once an hour, and when that still created too much of a distraction, I began keeping the program closed much of the day. The dismantling of my online life was far from painless. For months, my synapses howled for their net fix. I found myself sneaking clicks on the check for new mail button. Occasionally, I'd go on a day-long web binge. But in time, the craving subsided, and I found myself able to type at my keyboard for hours on end or to read through a dense academic paper without my mind wandering. Some old, disused neural circuits were springing back to life, it seemed, and some of the newer web-wired ones were quieting down. I started to feel generally calmer and more in control of my thoughts, less like a lab rat pressing a lever and more like, well, a human being. My brain could breathe again. My case, I realize, isn't typical. Being self-employed and of a fairly solitary nature, I have the option of disconnecting. Most people today don't. The web is so essential to their work and social lives that even if they wanted to escape the network, they could not. In a recent essay, the young novelist Benjamin Kunkel mulled over the net's expanding hold on his waking hours. Quote, "The internet, as its proponents rightly remind us, makes for variety and convenience. It does not force anything on you. Only, it turns out it doesn't feel like that at all. We don't feel as if we had freely chosen our online practices. We feel instead that they are habits we have helplessly picked up, or that history has enforced, that we are not distributing our attention as we intend or even like to." End of quote. The question really isn't whether people can still read or write the occasional book. Of course they can. When we begin using a new intellectual technology, we don't immediately switch from one mental mode to another. The brain isn't binary. An intellectual technology exerts its influence by shifting the emphasis of our thought. Although even the initial users of the technology can often sense the changes in their patterns of cognition, attention, and memory as their brains adapt to the new medium, the most profound shifts play out more slowly over several generations as the technology becomes ever more embedded in work, leisure, and education, in all the norms and practices that define a society and its culture. How is the way we read changing? How is the way we write changing? How is the way we think changing? Those are the questions we should be asking, both of ourselves and of our children. As for me, I'm already backsliding. With the end of this book in sight, I've gone back to keeping my email running all the time, and I've jacked into my RSS feed again. I've been playing around with a few new social networking services and have been posting some new entries to my blog. I recently broke down and bought a Blu-ray player with a built-in Wi-Fi connection. It lets me stream music from Pandora, movies from Netflix, and videos from YouTube through my television and stereo. I have to confess, it's cool. I'm not sure I could live without it. And I think the point there is that we often think that we're completely in control of how we use different technologies, particularly the intellectual technologies that help us find information and store information and share information. But in fact, and this again is something that we see over and over again in human history, a new technology, once it becomes popular, starts getting interwoven in our day-to-day lives, in social norms, in social expectations, and it becomes very, very hard to begin to try to back away from that technology, to temper one's use of it or curtail one's use of it. And that's very much true, I think, of the net and other digital media. More and more today, it's becoming an expectation in, for instance, people's work lives or in their social lives that you're always connected, that you're always available, that you're always monitoring information. And so to back away from the technology risks hindering your career or certainly your social life. If all of your friends are making their moment-by-moment plans through text messaging or through Twitter or through Facebook, it becomes very, very hard, and you have to make a sacrifice in order to back away. But I would say that even given those social pressures, in the end, really, we are all individually responsible for the choices we make, and particularly for the choices about how we use our mind and how we either pay attention or fail to pay attention. And so I think if you cherish those more attentive kinds of thinking, the contemplation, reflection, and so forth, you really have no choice but to try to balance your day-to-day life and your day-to-day habits of mind and make sure that, sure, you can use the web and use other digital media and communication systems from time to time to get the benefits, the enormous benefits from those, but you also have to be able to back away and practice the calmer, more peaceful, and in many cases, more solitary kinds of thinking. Because if you don't practice them, you're going to end up not being able to do that at all. So let me end there. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.